Our text this morning is 1 Thessalonians. I'd like you to turn, if you wouldn't mind, to that, and we're going to stand for the reading of the Scripture. 1 Thessalonians is written to a congregation that was only briefly started by Paul, 3 weeks. He got this baby of a church born, and then persecution came, and Paul had to leave, and he's so worried about them that he sends people back to check, are they doing well? And the answer is they're flourishing. And Paul writes a letter then to teach these babes in Christ some incredibly important things. The text we're going to read is actually our text for today and for next Sunday. We're going to be doing a two-part on this particular text. Let me read with you 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verse 11. Make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, to mind your own business, and to work with your hands, just as we told you, so that your daily life may win the respect of outsiders, and so that you will not be dependent upon anyone. In chapter 5, we're going to start with the 12th verse. Now we ask you, brothers, to respect those who work hard among you and are over you in the Lord and who admonish you. Hold them in the highest regard and love because of their work. Live in peace with each other. And we urge you, brothers, warn those who are idle. Encourage the timid. Help the weak. Be patient with everyone. And now we're going to go to the last chapter of the second book, 2 Thessalonians, the second letter he writes to them, verses 6 through 13. In the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, we command you, brothers, to keep away from every brother who is idle. Have you noticed how many times that's shown up here? Who is idle and does not live according to the teachings you receive from us. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow our example. We weren't idle when we were with you, nor did we eat anyone's food without paying for it. On the contrary, we worked night and day, laboring and toiling, so that we would not be a burden to any of you. We did this not because we did not have the right to such help, but in order to make ourselves a model for you to follow. For even when we were with you, we gave you this rule: if a man will not work, he shall not eat. We hear that some among you are idle. They're busy bodies. Such people we command and urge in the Lord Jesus Christ to settle down and earn the bread they eat. As for you, brothers, never tire of doing what is right. We're going to study this text. I'm going to need some help. I'm going to ask my help to come out, and you may be seated. And let's study this. What you have, or what you will soon have in front of you, is a quiz. I want you to sort of just wrestle with this a little bit as you go through this text. Here's your job. I want you to answer for me, which of these jobs or which of these are secular? That's your assignment. I want you to figure out what is secular here. We have Derek down there with Derek's mechanic, got at the motorcycle. We've got Ginger here. Ginger works in courts and takes depositions. In fact, if I were to stop and say, Ginger, what did I just say? She should have it there. She's actually done this for sermons for me. She'll even put in the uhs and the ahs and the ohs because she takes it down rather accurately. Karen here has the flowers. Anna here has what many of you would recognize coming from home, which would be pretty normal. Are the clothes all folded at your house and prepared? You're going to have Stephen here with the Reddings Mill Fire Department, and there's the medical bag that he has, and Bryson has the computer, and I'm preaching. My question is this: which is secular? Because that's the issue that Paul deals with. The issue in this is which one is the one that is holy in the sight of God, and which labor is not holy in the sight of God. The word secular, you recognize, you know where it comes from. If we go to Webster's Dictionary, here it is. Secular says, of or pertaining to this present world, or to things not spiritual or holy, relating to temporal as distinguished from eternal interest, not immediately or primarily respecting the soul, but the body, worldly. One of the things that Paul has to do with the group that are in Thessalonica is a recognition that in calling them to him, there were also ideas that had to be changed because the ideas were wrong. Luke 19:10 is a wonderful illustration of a passage where we tend to fill in the wrong word mentally. In Luke 19:10, you have the passage, "For the Son of Man came to seek and save what was lost." Immediately, though, most of us automatically fill into our head the word "who." "For the Son of Man came to seek and save who was lost." Who makes sense to us? Jesus came to save whose? And that's true. The word "who" could fit in there because it fits under that as a subcategory. But that text doesn't say who was lost. It says what was lost. One of the realities of life is that the insidious nature of sin is it not only captured us and we, the who's, got lost, but the ideas about humanity and life and the world and God and everything that exists in reality from the dreams and hopes of God, those things also got lost. It's very possible to be a who got saved, but you still have a what that's still broken in your thinking. And so he begins to talk to these who's that are saved and calls them back to a what. And the what he wants to talk to them about is the distortion about work, labor. He's going to layer this in multiple places. I want to talk to you about work. This sermon went a little long last hour, even though it's a two-part sermon. They thought I was doing both parts last hour. I'm actually going to do part one this week and part two next week. So I'm going to move as fast as I can through this, but there are distortions about work that are just realities. And I know that somebody's going to want to send me an email or a hostile letter on how I'm going to summarize this. Please don't. Hear me out before you at least send the hostile letter. And if you do, my name is Jay St. Clair, and you can get me at... Anyhow, one of the distortions about work is called the Catholic distortion. And it's a distortion you're very familiar with. It's a distortion that not only is historical in nature, it's a distortion that's present. And again, don't get mad at me. We'll balance this out in a second. But the Catholic distortion basically says this. I even went on a website this last week. I got on the website of a Catholic site. I got on a particular. I wanted to follow and see if the language still goes the same way. Still goes the same way. The Catholic distortion says this, that in life, there's a permitted will of God. There's the allowed will of God. Something he permits. But there's also something called the perfect will of God. And the permitted will of God and the perfect will of God are separate. And the call of God is whether you decide to leave the permitted will of God and go to the perfect will of God. On the site, I began the preliminary test to see if I wanted to accept the call of God to come to the perfect will of God and leave the permitted will of God. And I could become a nun or a priest if I... Well, actually, I probably could not have, but had I been able to pass the standards. But here's what the situation is. You recognize within that distortion. Within that distortion, it has the concept that says that individuals who do the holy work of God, those who hold the scriptures as their primary job, those who work in some kind of church paid way, someone who works under the umbrella of the spiritual realm, that's holy. And that everybody you're looking at back here, they settled for something. They settled for something that is less. You recognize that so-called Catholic distortion is not limited to a Catholic distortion. It is also a Protestant distortion. There is little doubt that if you've been in the kingdom at all, within the circle of the Protestant movement, you recognize that there have been camps and conferences and revivals. And the first night of the revival is, would you come and give your life to Jesus Christ? And the second night of the revival would be, would you rededicate your life? And the third night of it was this, would you give your life to full-time Christian service? And that's the language that's used. And out of that language that's used is, at its worst, a lie. It's a lie that says that there are different levels within the Christian life. And ultimately, somebody who says, I'll go into full-time Christian service, they become sort of grade A, type A employment. You need to know you're looking at lesser individuals back here because they're only in part-time Christian service. It's the implication. It is carried over. There is no doubt. The Protestant movement has done the same thing the Catholic has. It has made a separation. Now, sometimes the Protestant movement has gone the other direction, and the Protestant movement has said, okay, no, wait a second, there is no sacred calling up here. There's nobody up here. Everybody's down here. It's all just kind of mundane stuff. And even the Protestants even lose the fact that there is an incredible call to work by God. And we'll pick that up a little bit in the sequence. I don't know whether we have deliberately lived with this language because we really, really believe the deep lie, or whether we were just sloppy with language. But the idea of full-time Christian ministry, it's really not very good language. Because Paul is speaking to a group of believers that he wants to talk to them about how they follow Jesus Christ and how they live their life and what they do, and he talks to them about their work. I'm confident there are people in this room that struggle with some of the myths. Let me go over through some of those myths. Some of the myths people would struggle with that have been deeply damaging to you. They've stolen your humanity. They've stolen your joy. You believe this myth that who you are has come to Christ, but the what you believe has lagged behind, and you do not live the full life you ought to live, and it's ruined many things. I'm going to give you five or six of the myths that we believe. For some believe that your job is a waste of time. That from heaven's perspective, everything you do is just headed to the junkyard, and you're just kind of occupying, you're digging a hole, you're filling it up, you're digging a hole, you're filling it up. Karen, every one of those flowers are going to die. You need to know that. Every single flower is going to die. Arrange them however you want to, but Karen, they're going to go away. So basically, work is just the equivalent of a grown man's video game. When you unplug it, it goes away, the points all evaporate. It's all done. That's what work is. And some believe that. So it's secular. There's a second lie that some people believe, that work is done only for money. You have to work. It's a necessary evil. But they believe that work is a curse, and no doubt about it. In Genesis, there is a curse that goes along with work. But it's a difference between a curse that goes along with work, and we'll talk about that. But there are people who believe that the only reason for work is because of money. You need to have money for your family. You need to have money for your kingdom. So the necessary evil, the thing you have to endure, is work. And it's worth it because the ends justify the means. But basically, work is nothing more than acceptable cultural prostitution. That if it weren't for the money, if I didn't have to have the money, I would not work. And there are those of you that are ruining your life because you believe that lie. For some, a third one, you believe that work is a terrible interruption to the life you're supposed to live. Kind of like this one on the surface. That life has two wonderful play periods. One's when you're a little bitty kid. It's playtime. One's when you're really, really old. It's playtime. And there's this long, horrible intermission. There's this interruption. And that if we can just endure this interruption, if you can just endure the interruption somehow, some way, get out of this long interruption so that we can get back to playtime like we were supposed to be made. That's how we were supposed to do. You recognize that's true. The stats on this have really, really changed. They tell us, statisticians tell us, that this has been changing for 60 or 70 years. But basically 20 years ago, that if you interviewed anybody 45 years of age and above, and you asked this question, what's the number one thing you look forward to, 15 or 20 years ago, the number one answer was retirement. So a 45-year-old man or a 45-year-old woman, you say, what's the number one thing you look forward to? The number one answer was retirement. I just want to get over this horrible interruption so I can get to the play period or whatever it is that I was made for. Now then, it's dropped, you ask, and it's at age 37. That once you ask a 37-year-old man or woman, what's the number one thing you have to look forward to? You know, that's a long time to hold your breath. You'll start turning blue if you're 37 years old and you think your purpose in life is just to endure and hang on long enough till you can retire. You're going to hold your breath a long time. Fourth one. The fourth myth may be that spiritually that you believe you are less than you could be because of your job. That you are less than you could be because of your job. That you believe there's sort of the major leagues in life and the minor leagues, and there's a first-class Christian and a second-class Christian. And you've had to come to peace with the fact that you're going to be a second-class Christian because you just have to work a secular job. There's front seat on the bus Christians, and there's back seat on the bus Christians. And the front seat on the bus Christians are the Rick Bushnells and the Kevin Kleins and the Jace St. Clairs and the guy that teaches at the Bible College and the parachurch organization across town, the missionaries. But you didn't have that. You, a lot of reasons. Maybe you didn't have enough devotion. Maybe you didn't have enough opportunity. Maybe you weren't spiritual enough. Maybe you just settled, but you settled for taking computers apart like Bryce is doing. You just settled. You're just doing secular work, and it's made you to be a second-class Christian. Maybe the lie you believe is that you believe that you have to live in two worlds. That's the church world and the work world. And those two hang out in really different parts of town. And you just kind of live in those two worlds, and so you just a certain amount of you is just kind of split, a bit schizophrenic. It's kind of like having divorced parents. On the weekends, you hang out with this one, but on Monday, you pack your suitcase and you go live with the other one. And those two don't get along very well, but that's what you got for family. And there are individuals here today, you cannot figure what we do on Sunday morning, what in the world it has to do with the connection to tomorrow morning. They just, it's like two families. Or maybe you swallow a different lie. The sixth one, maybe you swallow the lie that you actually get your identity from your work. You work because it works for you. I'm somebody there. I may not be somebody to the rest of you, but I make great money and I succeed. And because the rest of you don't get it, you may call me all kinds of things like workaholic, and you may tell me out of balance and all kinds of things, but it's just sour grapes. I do well there, and you get your identity from work. All six of those are lies. And we all bear the scars of some of those lies. So the question we're going to somewhat deal with is, so how do these people, how do these six, how are they to see their work? How are they to imagine? Paul writes to the Thessalonians, and he writes with this thread. Christ not only redeemed you, but he redeems work. Work. And when he talks about how to live as sold-out believers of Jesus Christ, when he calls them to maturity, he starts talking to them about their work life. And their work life, he begins to raise up and say, this is. He says, in fact, if you can, he doesn't think work is a four-letter word. Which, by the way, it's not in the Greek. It's about a 9 or 10-letter word, but that's another story. It's something that's not secular. He says in this, he says, part of your Christian ambition, part of your passion for God is how you get up and you go to work. It is your Christian ambition. It's how you shine as a light in the universe. And so he's calling them to work that direction. He talks about how your everyday life advances the kingdom. How your everyday life is part of the kingdom strategy. And he talks about how the right view of work is part of Christian maturity. And if somebody has a wrong view of work, Christian maturity hasn't come. He even gets so blunt as to say that if someone misses this concept and doesn't understand work right, don't feed him. In a hospitable culture where you fed anybody, he says, look, if you have a Christian who says there's a heavenly thing and an earthly thing, and I only do heavenly things, and I'm not going to waste my time on earthly things, don't feed the guy. He's so wrong. He doesn't even know who he is. Don't feed him out of a discipline to bring him back to the truth. In Colossians, Paul will teach a similar church this. In Colossians 3, verse 23 and 24, he will say, for whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for men. Since you know that you will receive as an inheritance from the Lord, see an inheritance from the Lord as a reward. It's the Lord Christ you are serving. There was a gentleman, a young man, I met with this last week, who had an encounter with this verse through a very, very perceptive friend and boss. I probably have permission to use his name, but I won't. But he said, I was working at Sam's Club, so he's working. And he said, I got called in by my boss, who's a believer. He said, my boss looked at me, and my boss said, you need to stop working for Sam's Club. You've been working for Sam's Club. You need a new boss. It's about time you started working for the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. It's about time you started working as a follower of Jesus Christ. You need to change bosses. And he told about that interchange in that office and that conversation, and he said, it was a profound difference the day that I changed bosses. Most of you in this room don't need to change the company, but you do need to change bosses. Your boss doesn't work at a corporate office in Los Angeles or Chicago. Your boss doesn't work in an office two doors down and on the left. Part of the redemption of work is the realization that I have been called where I am, in the place I am, to not only redeem me to the Lord, but to redeem my mentality even toward work to the Lord. It's interesting that he even uses pay in that verse of Colossians. He says, you need to know that your pay won't come from your employer, your reward will come from the Lord. The idea that God himself knows how I work and who I work for, and he himself will reward me. I have pay stubs from my own employment through the years. I keep those for tax purposes. I'm sure I keep them longer than I need to, but I have those pay stubs. They tell me my history. Ultimately, though, this text tells me, no, Randy, your pay stubs are yet to come about your job. That would be true. There is still that which lies ahead of you. The proper end of work is not pay. The proper end of work is the glory of God. Ginger's sitting over here, and Ginger takes depositions and court things, and I was asking her about how she saw her work, and she talked about that when she's taking depositions, she's almost always in a critical situation of some kind. They tend to be litigation going on. They tend to be tragedies or accidents or something that's occurred. And Ginger said, one of the privileges I get is I get to sit there and pray for somebody who's going through a long, hard day with the grilling of the lawyers and the back and forth. And she said, I feel like God puts me in a spot that I can sit there and see the face of the person and pray for them while they're going through that entire deal. She talked about the first time she met Bonnie Brinforder. Bonnie has passed away. Bonnie was a part of this congregation, an elder's wife. She didn't know Bonnie at the time. She said Bonnie had a tough day on what she had to go through related to medical issues and her grilling and all kinds of things. And she just talked about praying for Bonnie that day, just praying for this woman who was sitting there going through that. How do you see what you do? Who is your boss? That's what he's talking about in this text. I want to make this very clear. We dare not ruin the word ministry by creating some artificial cardboard cutout who matches this so-called word ministry and limit it to what it really is. You see, if I don't understand the word ministry right, then Joseph was never in the ministry. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were never in ministry. If I misunderstand the word, then Noah and Ruth and Esther and Boaz and David were never in ministry. Do you understand the redemption of work? There are two calls in the Christian life. These two calls, this is pretty important stuff. They're both very clear and obvious in Scripture. The one call is to him. Every square inch of my life is his. Every part of me, my hopes, my dreams, my aspirations, there's no compartment I can give the Lord. My first call is me, and nothing of me can be withheld. The first call is to him. The English word that we have for vocation, that word comes out of the Latin. It's the Latin word to call. The Latin word for call actually gets its derivation and comes out of the sequence as the synonym that's used in the Greek. The Greek word to call, let me show you where it shows up. It shows up in 1 Peter chapter 2. In 1 Peter chapter 2, he says, "But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people belonging to God, that you may declare the praises of him who called you." That's the word. That's where we start all this. That's where your call comes from. "Him who called you out of darkness is marvelous light." The idea of vocation is the idea of not what you do for a living. The idea of vocation is I'm a Christ follower. That's your vocation. And so any appropriate use of that word in a technical sense means tell me your vocation. And the answer is every square inch of me is yours, Lord, to your glory. I want to live for your glory. Everything I am, I'm your image. I want to live in your image. But the second call is not to him. The second call is for him. Where shall I stand? You see, it's not only every square inch of my own life that he wants, but every square inch of this world is his. And it's the lie that it doesn't belong to him. And he is reclaiming every square inch of this world. And so the question is, since I have been called to him, where shall I stand for him? Where shall I occupy for him? I shall choose to occupy, and that's where the word occupation comes from. It has to do with the idea of where I occupy. And so I have a vocation that my life is given to him. I have an occupation that tells me where. And so Bryson, as a man who belongs to the Lord, gets to live out to the glory of God and give his life to the Lord, but he gets to occupy, let me take the skills God gave me and let me find a place with a screwdriver and a computer and the software that goes with it, and that's the place I'll occupy. And from that place, the glory of God will be disseminated. And from that place, a bit of heaven will take its reign. And you begin to go down Stephen with the fire department. And on it goes. And so you find that a banker banks for the glory of God, and a cook cooks for the glory of God, and a driver drives for the glory of God, and a salesman sells for the glory of God, and a homemaker homemakes for the glory of God. When he writes to these young believers, he's calling them back from the lies that had swallowed them. When it comes to work, two wonderful things come together. The two wonderful things that come together are, the first is God's part. God's part. In Genesis 1 and 2, God made us in his image. Made us in his likeness. You have a creator God who's been creating. You have a creator God who's been working. And God goes, now I'm going to make you son and daughter like me. And he made you creative. And he made you a maker. And he made you to rule. And he made you to have place. In Genesis 2, Adam is working in the garden. He is working in the garden long before the fall or anything else. It's what we do. Have you ever had a child, grandchild, that when you started the task, man, they wanted their little hammer on their belt right next to you? And they wanted their tape measure? Or they wanted their apron for the cook's apron around them? And you look at that little shadow running around with you, and you're so pleased by it. Ultimately, that's all of life. There's never a time where to grow out of that stage. God's a creator, maker God who's working and ruling. And so a part of it, he made us that same way. A powerful passage in Exodus 31. That passage in Exodus 31 is the first time that the phrase is ever used about the Spirit of God being put into someone. Who is it? Somebody who preaches? Who is it? Someone who prophesies? It's a guy and a list of guys who will follow. We're not going to go through the text. He puts the Spirit on, and they are craftsmen. I believe in a general sense God did that from the very creation. You were made to work. It's part of what your humanity is. And one of the greatest lies that has ever occurred is when you don't realize that the role you play just with your hands and going to work and your mind and occupying, you lose humanity. Eric Little from Chariots of Fire, it's an old movie that if you're young and haven't seen it, you need to go find the archives and pull it out. But Eric Little uses a phrase in there. He says, when I run, I sense his pleasure. That needs to be the case for the guy who drives. That needs to be the case for the gal who bakes. That needs to be the case for the guy who's moving cases of paper from one company to another. Why? It's a portion of God's creative nature and work nature, and he tore it off and gave to us. I am running from God when I run from work. Oh, there are thorns now. I recognize that. We'll pick that up next week. And work has its difficulties, and we're going to talk about that, how you manage that. But I want to remind you of a little parallel. The curse gave a woman pain in childbirth, but it didn't ruin the baby. Work has thorns, but it doesn't ruin work. Both still have their validity. It's only simply it's more difficult. There's also a truth we'll pick up and talk more about next week, that the fool will always struggle with work because work requires an acquired taste. You have to have enough discipline present to learn how to like to work, and you have to be able to see work as something that you do for the glory of God, and the fool never quite sees it for the glory of God, and the fool never gets the discipline to actually acquire the taste, and so the fool always struggles. But the wise man figures out the frame of work is for God. And the discipline and work becomes something that I sense his pleasure when I do it. There's also our side of work, and I like this part. I like this part. The Hebrew word abad is a Hebrew word that means work or worship, whichever way you want to use it. It's the same word. There are two Greek words. They're almost the same, but there's two Greek words. They both mean work or worship, depending on what you want to be. So what is work? Work ultimately becomes your act of worship. You guys are free to go back if you want to, out of the way. I know you've been sitting here quite a while. You're not free. You need to stay right here. I want to tell a simple couple of stories, and then I'll quit here in a second. For closer to 40 years than 35, I've been somebody's minister and preacher. Do you know why I'm in this? Some of you may say, no, we've wandered for a long time. Because the word abad, this work and this word worship is something that gives me great freedom. I can use it as illustration. When a man was bringing his act of worship, his act of sacrifice before the Lord, he would walk out into his herd of sheep, and he would look over the herd of sheep and decide, he got to decide which one he wanted to bring as his sacrifice. I could bring that one, but no, that one's not good enough. I don't want to take that one. I could take that one, but no. No, I get to choose which sheep I bring. That's my choice. I get to find the sheep, and I pick the sheep up, and I bring that as my act of worship and say, God, you own every part of me, and everything is yours, but God, I bring this. It's my act of worship. I'm in the ministry not because I was backed into the corner in the ministry, not because some voice came in the middle of the night. I'm not in the ministry because of anything else other than I got to stand, and I got to look at a herd. I could have done this as my act of worship and where I occupy for the Lord, or could have done this to occupy for the Lord, or could have done this to occupy. And I walked in the middle of those and said, okay, God, in light of whatever gifting I think you've given me, in the light of the things that I think I can do, God, would you be willing to accept, could I occupy for you here? And I chose what I do as my sheep, my act of worship, and where I stand. It put me in a unique intersection. It puts me unique. I mean, anybody that does what we call this silly word ministry, the one we restrict it. But anybody who does that, ultimately what you're saying is, I want to stand at the intersection where mainly Christian people are, and I want to help those Christian people succeed, and I want to help them flourish and serve the Lord. And so I've spent most of my life at that intersection. I have two brothers. I have a sister as well. But my brother Dennis, 4 years younger than I am, Dennis has a heart that is soft for the Lord. He has a passion for the Lord. My brother Dennis never settled for anything. My brother walked into his herd of sheep, and my brother looked at his giftings, and my brother began to build houses, and then my brother made a change, and he is now a lineman for the county. I'm going to write a song about that someday. But my brother has been, for 25 or 30 years, a lineman for Barton County Electric Co-op because he chose, as his act of worship, this is where I want to stand. And my brother has worked in the electrical supply business, and he has worked in the houses, and he has worked with his neighbors in his community and for the King, and he is occupied at this intersection, and there's not one ounce of difference in the sight of heaven between where the two of us stood. When I walk in, there will be no sacred, and there was secular. He has flourished and advanced the kingdom there, his act of worship. My question to you is, have you ever seen your work as your sheep? Have you ever seen your work as your intersection for where you stand in a world that needs reclaim for Christ? Have you ever seen your work and your worship as interchangeable? You say, well, what about Ecclesiastes? Oh, we'll pick that up next week. Tozier said, it's not what a man does that determines if it's secular or sacred. It's why he does it that makes the difference. It's why he does it that makes the difference. Are you involved in secular work or sacred work? When you run, do you sense his pleasure? The last thing. Mary Rogers is on the planning team for the worship. And so she knew what we were going to be talking about out of Thessalonians. And I think she'd been praying about it, thinking about it. I think God prompted her. I think her own thinking. She had a dream. It's an incredible dream. I'll summarize it, and probably won't summarize it perfectly, but Mary said she was there, and cell phone began to ring, and this phone's ringing and ringing and ringing and ringing, and the old woman who has the phone doesn't answer the call. And she says to her, aren't you going to answer the call? I mean, you got a call. Answer your call. And the old woman said, oh, my fingers are crooked and bent, and I've got arthritis, and so now somebody else can answer the call. And she said the phone started ringing on it. It was a man. And she turned, and there was a man who was a laborer. And she said to him, aren't you going to answer your call? And he just kept ringing. He said, oh, no. He said, I pick up trash. I'm a trashman. And he said, I get my hands dirty, and I don't want to touch. I'm not going to answer the call. Somebody else can answer the call. And she said the next phone started ringing, and it was a mother that had kids hanging on her hip. And she's got, and the phone's ringing, and it just kept ringing, And Mary said, I turned, aren't you going to answer the call? And going, oh, no, I've got kids. I'm really busy. I haven't got time. I've got a lot. And wouldn't answer the call. Can I tell you that I deliberated and thought how to get 50 of your cell phones to go off right now about this point in time in my sermon? Because the audio deal is this. When you came to Christ, that call started ringing. Not to change jobs, most likely. To change employers. To understand your vocation was to follow him. But you get to occupy somewhere. And what part of this earth are you going to stand and say at that intersection, this is the sheep I bring before the Lord, and this is how I'll advance the kingdom of God? I'll answer the call.